Welcome to AV Excel episode number 12, recorded April 14th, 2016, officially known as the Redo episode. AV Excel is made possible by your support. If we're helping make your home theater and entertainment more amazing, do us a favor. Head on over to patreon.com/AVExcel and support the show. Welcome to AV Excel, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And I'm Patrick Norton, and we would like to apologize for the lateness of this episode, which we have recorded for the second time today. Robert's magical notebook decided to eat all the audio last week.
It did awful, awful things to that audio track, unfortunately.
So you'll probably, well, we'll probably never know exactly what we said because the file is completely trashed.
It's so garbled. It was like two things were being recorded at once. I don't know. Some oddity was occurring. But
perhaps
anyway.
It was recording two things at once.
Technical snafu.
In any case, we're now double-checking the audio.
I'm staring at it as we speak.
And we'd like to thank you all for your suggestions about recording directly in other environments, and we'll talk about that on another episode. Oh, my goodness. Nano Infante tweets, at AVXL, at Patrick Norton, at Robert Herron, would love your take on projector lumens. Too bright versus not bright enough for basement home theater. And I gotta say, assuming your basement isn't like in the side of a hill with a gigantic wall of glass doors, facing, I don't know, the sunset or the sunrise, you're probably in the perfect situation in a basement because there's not a lot of light in your typical basement, which makes
the enemy of a good projection setup is light striking the screen. That is anything but the projector.
Yeah, it's a bad thing. For example, in my house, we use inexpensive but light-proof blinds on the front windows, and that takes it from I can almost see the color yellow over there in an animated feature to being able to see all of the detail and almost all of the contrast. My projector is now closing in on like 7 or 8 years old, so the dark levels, the black levels aren't as inky as I would like compared to new stuff. But that's a relatively, I think it's that projector's maybe pumping out 1,200 or 1,400 lumens, so it's not the brightest projector out there.
Well, but adequate for, if you have light a light-controlled room,
yes.
Then the lumen output on the projector is not necessarily the most important criteria you're going to be looking at. Effectively, the darker that room can be, you can take projectors down to pretty low levels, and that could also include using some of the settings in the projector that allow it to run the lamp at a lower mode that generates less heat, less noise, that kind of thing. Ideally, if you have a light-contained space to do your projection setup in.
Like a basement.
Yeah. Then I was using something like about 1,400 lumen max peak output for an LED-based projector. Plenty of light output for a 100-plus-inch screen in a darkroom environment. Likewise, though, when I was taking a 3,000 lumen Epson projector that I was testing in my living room with the screen back to the windows, but there was still a lot of light in the room and things like that. That's where 2,000+ lumens of light can really make a difference between something that looks pretty washed out versus, hey, this is usable in a room with some light in it. Again, if you're dealing with any chance of sunlight striking a screen or something like that, that's a lot of light. It's an uncontrollable
situation. The sun is considerably brighter than any projector you can buy today.
Yeah, you don't want to get into a light war trying to turn
with
a room.
Star.
Yeah, it can be done. Like one client I talked to, they had, I think it was a 12-foot screen, had to run 2 5,000 lumen projectors at it. And, that can work.
But they could see the view out over the hillside or whatever was outside those windows they refused to pull curtains
exactly.
over.
Exactly.
So that's 10,000 lumens, which is
a lot of light output.
Probably a lot of electrical consumption when they're watching videos, too.
I'm sure.
If you've never been to it, ProjectorCentral.com is a fantastic website, and they have their Projection Calculator Pro. And what they let you do is you choose a manufacturer, you choose a projector, and it throws up a whole bunch of information. For example, the recommended seating at throw distance, i.e. the throw distance is the distance from the lens to the screen, and the recommended seating is where you should plop your ass on the couch. Did I just say ass? Can we say ass on this podcast?
Yes.
But what's important about that is it gives you a range And it goes from yellow, where the projector might not be bright enough, to green, where the projector is ideal at a given max room lighting, to red, which means you're going to be tanning yourself by the incredible amount of light that's reflected off the screen at you. You know, so for this particular projector, you've got a nice, you know, you can get 17 feet from the wall and have a 141-inch screen. You know, in a reasonably dark room. If I go down to like a 110-inch screen, which, you know, is still pretty bright. Well, let's see, by 100 low ambient light, 120 inches and down around 110 inches, that's image brightness for rooms with ambient light. So the idea is like a 2500 lumen projector is, you know, dark room, you got like that 140 inch screen. By the time you get into some serious sunlight or some sunlight period, you're looking at maybe 100 to 110 inches on the screen. Conversely, if you are in the basement, you know, you might be able to get a 180 inch screen out of that. But if anybody opens the door upstairs, you might be really irritated by that light bouncing down.
I think 100 to 120 is a good, if you're thinking projection and you're concerned about light output, I definitely wouldn't go above 120 inch screen for most projectors.
Right.
The 92 to 100 or so inch are usually the good sweet spot for keeping it smaller. Mm-hmm. Your lens setup is going to affect how much light comes out of the projector.
Assuming you can actually do anything about your lens.
But most projectors have a zoom control, and that zoom actually affects the amount of light that comes out. Generally, the more wide open you can run that lens in terms of not zooming it in, you're going to get more light out of it. However, that will restrict then where you can put your projector in terms of the setup in the room. So ideally, it's going to be as close as possible with no zoom at all, and that will give you the most light output. Likewise, too, if you have the setup, everything's good, and the picture's too bright, then that's where you want to start reducing the lamp settings in the projector itself. Get it into its echo mode or whatever, something. Because all of these projectors are rated for lumen output, and generally speaking, they're all exaggerated in the sense that the spec is taken from whatever the max bright mode is of the projector. Mm-hmm. And it's usually an unwatchable, ugly mess of a picture. One example being with Epson projectors, their brightest modes are dump plenty of light out, but they're all greenish tinged. And they don't look that great. I mean, it's great if you're dealing with, like, you know, I'm showing a PowerPoint presentation or, you know, something business related. But when it comes to watching movies with accurate color, that's where you really want to get the you want to get it in a calibrated mode, and then in that calibrated mode, work with your light envelope, so to speak. I think it works pretty well.
Manage the light envelope.
I was recently dealing, though, with a nice JVC projector, their new RS400 series, and I have always kind of criticized JVC. They have epic contrast. Black is as black as you'll see on any projector. But the light output was always kind of like, meh. You got to be kind of careful. But this RS400, I put it up there with any of the good projectors I've used lately in terms of having plenty of light output. We were dealing with, I think, 100-inch screen or 110-inch screen. And we ended up ratcheting its iris control way down because when it was all said and done, this projector had light burns, so to speak. And by just simply having a nice, this is a more upgraded projector, probably like a $4,000 or $5,000 projector, but it had a beautiful little iris control. It could also be automatic too, where it would dynamically change the iris based upon scene content.
Oh,
but
wow.
That can be distracting. So if you can leave that kind of stuff off, that'll help with image quality. But there was,
we should also probably say, you know, if you're shopping for a projector right now, don't be afraid of a 1080p projector. First of all, because you're going to spend, you know, probably $3,000-$4,000 before you get a decent 4K projector right now. Second of all,
more than that.
Yeah, well, a lot more than that, actually.
Pushing closer to five digits for
that's
the time
a lot
being.
Of money. Yeah, so, you know, if you're thinking about buying a projector and you think it's something you're going to be living with for several years, you know, I would probably say hold off, or B, just buy a 1080p projector, because the 1080p Blu-ray looks fantastic, you know, on a 110-inch screen.
Awesome.
You know, so much of the resolution on a 4K television you're not going to see unless you are sitting 2 feet from it, which is typical for a computer monitor, but probably not the way you want to try to watch something fly across the screen.
General rule of thumb for analyzing 1080p video projects would be to put it up on a screen that's 6 feet wide.
Right.
So you think about that. That's a pretty good size display for 1080p resolution content, and that's to ensure that you can see all of the detail clearly. So if there is an issue with the encode or something,
right,
you can perceive it. So Yeah, don't be afraid of 1080p. And an affordable projector, too, can get you started mm-hmm. with the room you're thinking of doing. It's like, well, I got to put a mount up anyway. Right. I've got to get my audio squared away. You know, maybe hold back on going with the super high-end projector if you're on the fence about what model specifically. And just get all the other gear set up. And then you can always, you know, drop in another projector later.
You can always spend thousands and thousands. Yes. Well, I mean, BenQ's HT2050 doesn't cost that much. Does a great job.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's like selling for $800 on Amazon right now. You know, you don't have to spend a fortune. And I will say, if you're thinking about spending a fortune on an 83-inch television, buy a projector and a screen instead. You'll thank me later.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or even a 70-inch television.
Well, Samsung's 88-inch. Right. That's still $20,000. So, you know, you can
quickly, a lot of money.
Quickly jump up there. Sure, it has high dynamic range and other sweet 4K features, but
yeah,
we're talking here quality projection experience.
Don't buy 4K for the pixels. Buy it for the high dynamic range. And don't buy a 4K television unless you know it actually supports high dynamic range. And by the way, there are two different formats of high dynamic range. We'll talk about that later.
Don't make me cry.
MLB games on DirecTV in 4K.
Awesome.
Did it work? Started this weekend, right?
Yeah. Actually, the very first game of the season was the Giants and the Dodgers. San Francisco and LA, and they were all set to broadcast it. If you're a DirecTV subscriber and you have the appropriate gear, specifically some of their 4K supporting hardware mm-hmm. from DirecTV, like the 4K Genie Mini, their latest Genie HD DVR, the HR54, mm-hmm. and you subscribe to either DirecTV's Ultimate or Premier packages.
That's a long list, man.
If you have all that lined up, you had the opportunity then to watch, I want to say, 25 games this season that will be streamed in 4K live. However, I heard the very first game had some technical issues, and many people just saw a logo and were then forced to go hunting back through the channel guide to find something actually showing the programming content. So I like it. It's yet another step forward in getting video 4K, live event 4K stuff actually into the home. Granted, this is pretty a pretty edged case in the sense of what you need and what you have to have. And
right.
I'm sure you need a specific.
More often than not, you need a reasonable internet connection and whatever applications are pre-installed in your HDTV or Roku Model 4. But DirecTV's got a lot of stuff going on.
I'm wondering, though, if DirecTV's doing this over satellite, too. I know they have some new hardware up, and I'm willing to bet that they're probably delivering that via.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they are delivering it over satellite.
Rather than streaming it, but still, yeah.
I'm just saying, you know, if you're not ready to make the investment, there are other opportunities for 4K content.
I am enjoying my 4K season. Not 4K, actually. I'm streaming MLB TV on the app this season, again. Yeah. Got the reduced price thanks to that.
If you're a baseball fan, you don't have the MLB app, just get the MLB app.
Yeah. There's two ways of getting that, too. There's one app or one version of it that's pretty affordable that gives you, I think, just your favorite team. But then I get the package that just gives you every game.
All the games.
And enjoy! And I have to use it with a local service, but I use it with a service called Unlocator so that when I have blackout conditions of my favorite
local teams. You can pretend you're in another state.
Somewhere. I don't know where it's telling them I am, but
who cares?
It works.
So. 4K UHD Blu-ray update. Paramount's first 4K UHD Blu-ray is a $48 Star Trek combo pack. June 14th, it's going to be released June 14th. That's the 50th anniversary of the first Star Trek episode on television. 4K Dolby Atmos, 3-disc UHD Blu-ray Digital HD combination. Now, I should probably check to see if the price has shifted on Amazon. But we're talking about, at this point, $48 for either Star Trek or Star Trek Into Darkness.
And this is the relaunch.
These are the reboot
new
movies.
New reboot movies. Cool. Still, that seems like a lot. $48 for Star Trek.
Don't get me wrong. Huge fan of the reboot. I mean, I'm almost tempted to say I would love to see, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but there's a scene where there's this big ship called the Enterprise and it starts blowing stuff up and it's really awesome. That might look really cool in 4K.
It's got good action.
It's got good action. But they're coming. You know, this is so much like the early days of Blu-ray. You know, when it's like, hey, there's 33 titles, 34 titles, 35 titles. And you would just kind of wait for them to show up.
I have a search for Blu-ray movies that are currently less than $10. So now I think I'm going to have to re-up one here for UHD Blu-ray movies that are maybe, say, $20 or less. Because it's nice when you come across them, and sometimes they're a lot less than $10 for a Blu-ray.
Right.
But when you come across a favorite movie or content that you know you watch more than once, having it on a Blu-ray disc is the best way to go, just for that extreme bitrate, pristine audio and video quality. And it is, I know a lot of people are more into the convenience of streaming, but
I'm laughing because, like, you can buy The Revenant for $25 on 4K UHD Blu-ray, but, you know, it's a movie that I don't think a lot of people are going to watch twice, hence the, you know, reasonably accessible price. But if you pull up Star Trek UHD Blu-ray on Amazon, you get Star Trek 11 Blu-ray 2009 for $9.90. Go Chris Pine. And you get the Star Trek, I guess it's 11. Sorry, I'm going numerically dyslexic. Star Trek 11 2009 on the 4K Ultra HD version, $47.99, available for pre-order. So the $48 price is holding. $25 for The Revenant in 4K. Nick Bichelle wrote, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, I guess, tweeted, any picture quality increase of UHD Blu-ray when watching in 1080p compared to regular Blu-ray? No. And actually, depending on how good the scaling is on that, you know, UHD Blu-ray player, it might be bad because you're essentially quartering the number of pixels, right? What you want for your 1080p screen is a 1080p Blu-ray. If you have the brand new UHD Blu-ray player that you spent $400 for and you got a couple of those discs at $30 or $40 each, you can plug them into a 1080p TV. Not that I've tried it. You should be able to plug it into a 1080p
TV.
It'll work. Yeah, it's just, you know, kind of an incredible waste of money and resources.
Totally, totally. And visually, there are some differences between the Blu-ray editions of the movies that are out and... Right. And I'm thinking specifically of The Martian. They found a couple of scenes where, honestly, you could perceive more detail in specific items within a scene on the Blu-ray compared to the same scene processed through high dynamic range, where probably due to the, oh, we got to really make this a bright reflection right here, it ended up blowing out some of the detail that was available there. So, yeah.
Are those HDR at this point?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's part of that initial launch list of titles. And I happened to notice that one in particular. And I will say I prefer the overall look of ultra-high def Blu-ray just for the saturated colors, the detail, the brightness details in particular. Fantastic. But if you don't have the UHD TV and, you know, if you're missing that part of the equation, don't be buying an ultra-high def Blu-ray player at this point.
Are those Dolby or 10 or both?
There are no Dolby HDR discs.
Okay.
That's only streaming currently.
Okay.
I want to say Amazon's going to offer some Dolby Vision coming up later this year in their streaming offerings. Mm-hmm. And I know Netflix will be as well. But right now, all your discs are
HDR 10.
HDR 10, which means if you have one of those fancy new Vizio TVs, you're not watching any of that.
So, really?
Yeah, because they don't have HDR 10 support yet. Oops. And it's coming in hopefully another couple months, but speaking of Vizio, they just launched a couple new TVs this week, too. Ooh.
Those are the new...
Well, they have the new P-Series we talked about, I think, a week or two ago, and then the new E and the M-Series refreshes have just popped up. And with the M-Series in particular, that's be the one I think more folks are focused on. It effectively gives you about half the number of local dimming zones that the new P-Series has. Mm-hmm. So whereas you had like about 128 zones on the P-Series, you got about half that on the M-Series. And it will also include the 6-inch tablet remote, although at a slightly lower resolution, 720p versus 1080p for the P-Series tablet remote.
Right.
So, good news, though. I mean, the pricing is going to be fantastic. Larger screen sizes. And I would love to get the P and the M-Series side by side with each other just to see... Just to see what changes were made or what things were sacrificed along the way. I think, number one, you're going to see with the M series probably won't have the advanced wide color support that the P series has. So the P series is still going to be their premium model for Vizio's 2016 offerings, aside from that reference series TV, which nobody should own.
I feel like you shouldn't really, you know, if a television, if you're looking at a 4K television, if it doesn't support Dolby Vision and or HDR10, I wouldn't buy it.
If you can hold off for another year, that's not bad advice for a lot of people. I wouldn't be in a hurry unless you're just itching to go.
Right.
You got everything lined up. You know what
I must have the pixels.
Must have them.
Oh my goodness.
But I have no problem telling people to hold off. I'd love to see what the final prices are, too, for the things that are coming out this year, later this year. And then by the time they announce new stuff next January, I think the second go around with all of this technology will be a better experience for all. There'll be more titles, more streaming options, more price points, more manufacturers with capable TVs.
Which means more content, usually.
Totally. It's going to be a completely different game in another 8 months or so.
Speaking of which, a lovely, lovely article up on Engadget.com. Quote, as of mid-March, we have been providing both Dolby Vision and HDR10 streams to supported TVs, giving Netflix members an even more visually stunning experience. So Marco Polo Season 1, Marvel's Daredevil is out now. Marvel's Daredevil is coming. So if you do have one of the 4K TVs that supports Dolby Vision and or HDR10, fire up the Netflix, at least as long as you have all of the bandwidth for 4K streaming. Cause it's,
I've been getting my Netflix on lately.
Oh, my goodness.
Getting caught up on my Archer Season 6, because I think Season 7's out now. So Archer FX.
Oh, my goodness. We had a question asking about wireless rear surround sound speakers, and I apologize. I lost the question. I did have it last week when we recorded this the first time.
Done.
But I would like to apologize for not having the name. But basically, somebody wanted to know if there was a way to do wireless rear surround sound speakers, and there is. One of the simplest ways to do it is Rocketfish, which is a house brand at Best Buy. They have the Universal Wireless Rear Speaker Kit, and it's essentially two boxes. One goes near your AVR or your HDTV or wherever the source for those two rear channels is coming from.
The transmitter?
Yeah, I mean, it's a couple of boxes. They cost $100. There's a pair of 25-watt amplifiers in that box. So you still have to run wires from the... So there's two boxes. One goes in, you know, plugs into your AVR, your television. The other one goes by the rear surround sound speakers, the rear channels. And you have to run cables to those rear channels. It doesn't mystically send the information wirelessly to the speakers themselves. It goes between the two boxes. And then from the second box, there's speaker wires. But it's got a couple of 25-watt amplifiers. People like it. You know, some of the, you know, there's some speculation that the construction is cheaper than it used to be or something like that. But you're talking about a product like 1,100 reviews on the Best Buy website, and it's averaging 4.3 stars. It's doing all right.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad.
I mean, if you want to spend more money, you can get the Soundcast Surroundcast kit. It's basically the same concept, only in this case, it's $200. I've seen that up for sale on crutchfield.com, and it's got a 50-watt amplifier. You know, basically, you know, you connect the two box, you got a 40 or 50-foot range, don't put a lot of walls in there. Usually they have speaker level, or excuse me, gain controls to kind of tweak things. But it's pretty easy to do. You just have to be able to run the cables at the back half of the viewing room. So
totally.
Samsung, Definitive, so many others offer wireless surround sound bars with either you know surround or you know sound bars and or full you know 5 or 7 piece speaker kits where they do wireless connections to the rear surrounds there. So there's a ton of options
totally.
Out there.
And if you happen to be dealing with a carpeted room, a nice metal fish tape and flat speaker wire and running that under the carpet to the back of the room, it doesn't take a lot of time.
No.
And then you have all the options you want then in terms of size of speakers or power loads and things like that.
Behind the baseboard trim.
Totally.
You can pop the baseboard trim off without the
landlord. Probably even more options there. You don't have to worry about, you know, a flat wire design. Right. I think if you're going to go under carpet, though, you try to just keep it flat so it doesn't stick up like a little hump.
Always awkward when people trip over the speaker wire under the carpet.
Excellent.
Sorry, I had that roommate once. So yesterday, a week ago, several days ago, Samsung unveiled its flagship, the KS9800.
Yeah.
Mr. Robert Herron was in New Jersey.
New York. I was in Manhattan for this one.
I'm terribly sorry.
No, it was good.
When I think of Samsung, I think of New Jersey. And I am holding a Quantum Dot. I am holding two vials of Quantum Dot in my hand.
You have some Quantum Dots.
And it's essentially two of those little handheld keychain flashlights.
Blue LEDs shining
these into two vials. These two vials look like a backstory for a superhero. If I press, and it's very obviously blue light, because once you manage to manipulate everything around and half blind yourself, it's like, oh, it's blue light coming out of that flashlight. And it hits one vial of quantum dot material, and it turns deep red. And you hit the other dot of quantum vial of quantum dot material, and it turns a bright, punchy green. Man.
That is the summary of how a quantum dot LCD works right there. A blue backlight system, blue LEDs in the back, and then instead of going through liquid quantum dot materials like you have in the two vials you're holding right there, they impregnate that material within a sheet of film that gets applied in lieu of a diffuser layer on the panel itself. And with the blue light going through, some of that gets converted into it strikes the red and the green quantum dot particles, creating those two color peaks. And then the end result, if all is working as it should, is you get a very robust white light, a very well saturated white light, that then can be refiltered back into the red, the blue, and the green subpixels that make up the pictures we see. So
it sounds a little Rube Goldberg, but the end results are pretty spectacular.
It's how they've achieved wide color gamut on modern LCD televisions. That, and there's another method as well that Vizio and a few other people use, where you simply take the blue LED and you put a yellow phosphor material over it, where, red and green making yellow. And that's another way to do it. Although the highest color saturation, or the widest gamut I've seen so far, is using the quantum dot material as a sheet within the TV itself. The KS9800, very reminiscent of the 9500 from last year, the JS9500 for their the design in particular. It has that chamfered bezel, beautiful looking metal trim, a curved screen design, super, super bright TVs this year.
1,000 nits.
Minimum. These things can hit probably closer to 1,400.
Whoa.
So
that's leave the curtains up and watch whatever you want to
watch. For the next few years, we're going to be seeing basically an arms race of who can build the brightest TVs, and at least among the LCD guys.
Do they have night mode so I don't wreck my vision trying to watch?
Totally. And you know what? You're not displaying a full frame of white, generally speaking. You're talking like for those pinpricks of light in the star field, or that chrome glistening off the bumper.
So 1,400 nits for selected punchy white elements on the screen.
For brief periods of time.
Got it. I feel better now.
Yes. Pretty impressive. The screen surface, the top screen, is using an updated version of an anti-reflective technology based upon a moth's eye. Moths apparently have these little structures on the surface of their eye that minimize reflection, so as they hunt at night, they're not giving away their position. Similar here, and that helps with not only light control in a well-lit room, also when it is brightly lit in a room, the less it reflects, the more the color can be exposed, so to speak. Curved design again for the 9800. The KS9500 that I looked at is an edge-lit design. That is going to be curved as well. They have a 9000 they announced as well. That's a flat screen. We're looking at May, June timeframes, and no Dolby Vision support. Dun da da da.
Interesting.
I'm thinking Dolby Vision requires a chipset for full support. So if your TV doesn't have that chipset in it to begin with, you're not getting Dolby Vision love, at least with any TV that's claiming to do it.
Interesting.
However, full HDR10, part of the alliance among the manufacturers to make it all work and interplay nicely. I actually got a chance to see the flagship, the KS9800, full array local dimming. I had to see that side by side with LG's G6 OLED, their brand new one with HDR.
I remember from CES that the G6 OLED looked spectacular.
It really is a fantastic looking set. Glass backed, probably like a quarter to a half an inch thick sheet of glass that the OLED's actually mounted on, and it looks fantastic. In the lab, the brief amount of lab time I had with both the TVs side by side, there were distinct differences, though, in picture quality between the OLED, the LG's best OLED, and now Samsung's upcoming LCD. The advantage that you have with the quantum dot material is that when you're creating the red, the blue, and the green light to mix into white, you can have very careful control over the spectral characteristic of the light. You don't want the red, the blue, and the green all kind of munging together and muddling up the color process. You would like them as distinct as possible. And that is something I'm seeing in visual examinations, as well as measuring it with a very expensive scope to see how the light is produced. I'm finding that the quantum dot screens, Samsung's in particular, are doing a fantastic job delivering both the bright detail and maintaining good color quality within that bright detail. In a couple of specific cases I saw on the G6 OLED, when you started getting into the peak bright details, uh-huh. suddenly color could get a little weird because of okay. the way the OLED works, frankly. All of LG's OLEDs are red, blue, green, uh-huh. W for white. So there's actually four subpixels per pixel on okay. their TVs. And I find that in order to achieve the super bright light output on an OLED currently, uh-huh. You're turning up just white in addition to red, blue, and green. And adding more white light into anything, it's like, you know, diluting the color a little bit, or it can introduce some oddities in terms of peak bright detail. Still, either one of these TVs, absolutely fantastic looking. Mm-hmm. But when it came down to just absolute color, seated in the money seat, I preferred what I was seeing from Samsung's LCD technology. Right. Now,
that was also in Samsung's lab under Samsung's testing conditions with Samsung's calibrations on both monitors.
There, that has to be mentioned. And although I was there specifically to hammer on everything, so.
Right. So not to completely disrupt this, but we were talking before, and you mentioned that there's an Internet of Things hub built into the KS9800, which to me is like, yeah, why not? If you can put an Internet of Things hub in a thermostat, why not put it in, or, you know, a thermostat company can build the hub for Internet of Things. Why not dump it in the TV?
I like this, actually. At first I'm like, okay, what's the point of having my hub or the TV be the hub for all
How
my...
often do you upgrade your TV?
Exactly. not as often as other stuff in my life. So, but Samsung had picked up a company called SmartThings a mm-hmm. while back. And they have rolled that technology into their 7, 8, and 9 series TVs in the sense that all of these TVs can act as a device within the SmartThings platform. You can right. actually do basic control over the TV. It can just be another device among a hub you already have. However, for specifically the 789 owners, they get a free USB stick that contains the dual radios needed for, in this case, mm-hmm. SmartThings supports Zigbee and Z-Wave. And then the hub basically just runs the software. So the only thing the TVs were missing to be a full-blown hub was just the radios and the antennas specifically. And having that is just a free upgrade. You get a USB stick, mm-hmm. And boom, add that in, and then you have, you know, effective control over on an open platform. I mean, the Zigbee and Z-Wave are two of the biggest out there in terms of just...
Well, Zigbee and Z-Wave are communications. Zigbee and Z-Wave are communications protocols more than a platform. But
so you get hundreds of devices yeah. supported right out of the box, and I don't see you being locked into anything going down this route. So I thought that was pretty cool as well.
It is cool.
At the very end of the Samsung launch for their TV, they ended up having a little entertainment with Charlie Puth. I'm not hip to all the new music. This is a young dude who had a number one song with the Fast and the Furious soundtrack that just came out.
For Seven?
Pardon me?
For Fast and Furious 7?
Yeah. And it turns out I was actually quite impressed with the guy who just could sit down at a piano and entertain a bunch of, you know, pixel nerds for 30 minutes. That was pretty cool. So I got to say, I don't think I'm running out to buy his music right now, but I was impressed by his demeanor, I guess would be a good way to put it. Just the way he presented himself into, I don't know.
The man took name and kicked ass?
I thought so, and he was feeling pretty sick, too, so it was like he hung in there. I think he was just shooting chloroseptic like it was going out of style. But
props to that.
Yeah.
Speaking of Fast and the Furious, Fast and Furious 8 apparently is due 2017, and the Fast and Furious 8 poster is on Facebook right now. I saw a movie in a movie theater this weekend with
awesome.
My 3-year-old. It was great. It was like 11:30 on us. And let me put this into context. This is, I'm pretty sure, the first time I've seen it in a movie theater since my wife and I were dating before we got married. Like, it's been like 10 years, I think, since I've seen it. Let me rephrase that. Outside of the Dolby Theater, which is really loud. I think this is the first time I've seen a movie in a movie theater, like, in a decade. It was not bad. The seats were wide. They reclined.
Oh.
If you go to a movie a little later than 11:30 on a Saturday morning with your three-year-old to see Zootopia, you can get dinner served in the seats.
Nice.
It was very nice. I don't know if it was as nice as being on the couch eating burritos from Taqueria Mexicana in the comfort of my own home, but it was much nicer than I anticipated.
That's how I felt about seeing The Martian when I was back in New York, and now we have recently a new theater here in the Bay Area that's mm-hmm. Dolby Cinema, and I would be seeing what movies they have playing in that particular
we
room.
Have a movie night,
and I'm gonna with quality like that so close by, and if you really want to get a taste of what 4K can do.
I think it's time for us to just give up the podcast, sell the home theaters, and just start spending... Oh, wait, that was $8 with a significantly discounted Saturday morning taking the kids to the movie tickets. I can't afford to see movies in a movie theater.
I was going to say, that's a bargain. Bargain!
Bargain! But you know, as you were just pointing out, it's if you haven't seen a movie in a theater in a while, if there's a decent theater by you or one of the really fancy ones, it's worth checking out.
Especially if you have access to any of the newer projectors, too, right. In your local theaters. And if you have one theater that has like a 4K digital projector, let alone one of those Christie digital laser projectors or somebody's sweet, you know, Dolby Cinema version of a theater. That's always that is just worth treating yourself to if you have a movie in mind that you've been waiting to see or something like that, because mm-hmm. that also shows you too like the target of what we're looking to do for home theater
right.
coming up this year. I mean, this is where everything's pushing toward brighter, more contrasted,
right.
better, and you get better color no matter what in the movie theater anyway. So.
Color is really the thing that the you know my long suffering optoma, which has served my family and I above and beyond the call for thousands of hours. The black levels are really what making me want to upgrade, because they're not really black levels so much as they are dark gray levels.
Single chip DLP.
Yeah.
Yep. You can't really, yeah. All you can do is flick them on and off real quick to make a good black, but still.
The KS9800, the Samsung KS9800, are those shipping now?
May, June timeframe, okay. I want to say, depending on the size. And that should also be in line with the new KS9500, 9000, 8500. All of that should be coming along soon. They also have a new 6 Series TV I forgot mm-hmm. to mention. But the only thing different between that and the 789 is that while it will be compatible with the SmartThings platform, mm-hmm. it won't have that ability to act as a hub. So if that was something you were really thinking about, what's the low end on that one? To get me into full hub control for my new Samsung TV, it would be starting with the 7 series. So I'll be looking forward to that as well. Yeah, and those LG OLEDs too just look fantastic.
And those are shipping now.
Yeah, the 65-inch G6 is out now. I haven't seen any other sizes yet. Mm-hmm. They better get a 77-inch out. They need a bigger screen. Bigger.
I'm a little afraid to find out what that's going to cost because and it is a flagship television, but the LG OLED 65 G6P 65-inch 4K Ultra HD Smart OLED TV. Can you tell I'm reading off of Amazon?
Ba-ba-ba.
That is $8,000 with free Prime shipping once available.
That's the 65-inch?
That's 65-inch. It's temporarily out of stock.
Yeah. It's a popular TV. Yeah. The 77, I'm betting you, pushes probably... I'd say 15 to 16, right. Easy. So,
but you know those you know the EF 9500 and the 65 E6P, those are down to like $5,000 and $6,000 now. So, you know, prices are coming down on flagship OLED television.
I'm telling you, there's always Vizio with their full array local dimming.
I still think it's crazy that they did full array local dimming on a television for that price.
Vizio. I'm glad they are doing it, especially the new M series and that P series that's out. That's a couple of terrific values right there.
Oh,
that,
my goodness.
You know, kind of like that midpoint between full-blown 4K experience and something definitely better than the HD experience we've left. So.
Tim, a.k.a. at Home Brand Cola, writes in, "Hi, guys. Enjoying the new podcast. Is it still new after 11 episodes? Well, Tim, we hope to keep it new, exciting, and fresh for as long as we do it. And we're going to keep re-recording episodes as long as we keep blanking them out or erasing them."
Yes. I'm already waiting to check this one, like a pause, like for a minute.
Should we pause and check it? No. Let's pause and check it.
No.
Tim says, "Anyway, my TV is a 6-year-old 50-inch 1080p Panasonic plasma. I can't remember the exact model. I'm still enjoying it, but I'm looking to move to 4K within the next 6 months now that Ultra HD discs are a thing, and hopefully my internet bandwidth will get upgraded to something that supports UHD Netflix streams. I specifically chose the plasma for image quality. The room has well-controlled light. I don't care about any of the smart features on newer TVs. I'm happier to rely on my Roku and Apple TV for content and Blu-rays, of course. I've been looking at new TVs in stores in terrible lighting conditions with terrible input signals, and I am having a hard time picking one that looks good to me. The OLED TVs I have seen do look amazing, but they're currently out of my price range and the size I want, 55-plus inches. My questions, are modern LCD LED TVs up to the black levels of a plasma or close enough that I'm going to be happy with it? What would be the current equivalent TV that is dumb as a post but has great image quality? My parents bought a modern Panasonic LCD, but it's got a bunch of image processing on it. I can't stand. Thanks, Tim." Well, first of all, just give up on trying to find an LED, LCD or OLED flat panel that doesn't have smart features built in. Just let it go.
There are some, but I don't even consider it. You know,
buy for image quality. You're not going to save any money, probably, and if you do, you're probably going to make compromises on image quality on the glass. So just ignore the smart features. Use your Roku. Use your Blu-ray player. Use your Apple TV.
Totally. You do not have. I get that complaint a lot. It has to be a dumb TV, and I'm like,
I would like Samsung to offer a dumb TV, or LG to offer a dumb TV, but it does not help them. It doesn't. They do marketing deals. They get promotion. They do blah 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 blah. And there's just most people go in and they're like, well, it's got all the software built into the TV. I should get this one. It's got a Netflix button right there.
Just a quick throwback to that Samsung TV. Right. I think one of the best things about it is the fact that when you plug in your devices, like your cable box, your Blu-ray player, your Xbox, whatever, PS4, that TV has the ability to automatically detect all those devices and set them up for use with the universal remote that it comes with. And that sounds like something that should have been around for a long time. And maybe it has in certain means, but it never fully fleshed out. And Samsung worked really hard to make this new interface about as simple as it gets, and to actually keep the original TV remote in your hand. Mm-hmm. So you're not, okay, I have a cable box. I'm going to basically connect it, throw the TV's remote in the box, and then go back to my cable box remote or my satellite box remote. And this is the first time I'm really like, I think you can now safely put away a lot of those other device remotes and have that one TV remote actually control everything. I was saying that because LG is doing something similar too with WebOS 3.0 on their new 2016 TVs. Uh-huh. They put so much effort into that interface that they have to tie it in to ideally network-enabled things.
Right.
So you're gonna end up with some smart functionality on any premium TV for sure. The only oddity I could think of would be like, the lack of a tuner hardware support built into the new Vizio TVs. But that's not really even the same thing. It's like, those are all still connected devices. You still want all of those firmware updates and everything that are going to be flying down for, you name it, HDR support, to update menus, to make it so that when you do plug and play device detection, it can go right out online and find the appropriate info for it, populate your channel guides and things like that. All of that. And so it's like, I'm not so concerned about the smart stuff if it's there. I can always ignore it, like you said.
You can ignore the smart stuff. You can turn off most of the image processing on the the television. Like, you said your parents' television had a bunch of image processing on it. You can't stand. Most of that you can turn off.
Usually,
Inside of the processing.
I was working on a LG OLED today, though, and it had some image enhancement features that clearly were still enabled, even if I set everything to zero. So
that's irritating.
That can happen, but that's a pretty weird case, though. So
the nice thing is, though, is the today's LCD televisions are certainly approaching those like Kuro levels that were unthinkable for black levels, 5, 10 years ago, 5, 7 years ago.
With the right panel, and if you're seated front and center. Well, specifically.
How about, since an $8,000 panel is out of the question at this point for Tim, what about the P-Series, the 55-inch P-Series from...
That's an interesting case because he's coming from a plasma, so right. He's used to generally consistent wide viewing angles. And the one interesting thing about the new 2016 P-Series from Vizio, the 55-inch model in particular, is that it's unique in the sense that it's an IPS-based panel, in-plane switching. And that gives you wider viewing angles, although technically it isn't able to achieve the black level of the more traditional LCD panels called vertically aligned or VA style. Now, if a 55-inch panel is good enough, like for this year, all of LG's LCD TVs are all IPS-based displays.
Right.
But the thing that Vizio is doing that LG isn't is that full array local dimming system.
That's
so
big.
The cool. It's like the best of both worlds here. You're going to get the wide viewing angle on the 55-inch P series with its IPS panel, but then its ability to then dynamically control the backlight system through that local dimming should give it really, really good contrast, even off axis viewing or whatever. So I would just, the short answer, yeah, the 55-inch P-Series with the IPS panel, if that screen size is big enough. Otherwise, you know what, just go bigger. At that point, I would also probably consider, you know, on a budget, 65 or larger P-Series as well, just for the full array local dimming, although, you know, the off-axis won't be quite as good, but when you combine that with that full array local dimming, that can really make black look black on an LCD.
Right.
That makes a big difference. And then if you tie into that IPS panel for the 55-inch to give you the wide viewing angles, that's going to be a win-win, I think. Mm-hmm. And then it will also consume dramatically less electricity than that plasma you had. So, and compared to a six-year-old plasma, there aren't many plasmas that old that I would say had great black levels.
Right.
I mean...
Well, compared to the LCDs at that time.
Oh, without a doubt. And the darker the room you could put them in, they would look a little bit better. But you're going to have tremendous more light output, very good contrast performance, especially straight on. And it's a lot easier to manage. You could wall mount that 55 nice and easy. Or go bigger, too. I mean, if you have the space for it, it's do it up. Thing. But
oh, my goodness. Hopefully, Tim, that helps you out a little bit. I watched The Big Short last week. Fantastic movie.
I hear a lot of great things about that.
I thought it may have oversimplified the financial crisis, but it's fun.
Good.
You know, or as fun as it can get until it gets really serious in the last act. Last week, the Criterion Collection released Only Angels Have Wings. It's Howard Hawks directing, Cary Grant, Gene Arthur and Rita Hayworth. It's a pretty interesting classic movie out there. And as I mentioned earlier, if you enjoy Leonardo DiCaprio suffering, The Revenant came out today on Blu-ray and Ultra Blu-ray, along with reissues of all the X-Men movies. And The Hateful Eight Blu-ray is on sale on Amazon for under $20. It is an utterly beautiful piece of photography. And it's Quentin Tarantino, so there's blood and violence and mayhem.
Love it.
A lot of good stuff.
We're
going to be talking about DIY video calibration on our next episode, which hopefully will be up by the end of this week.
Yeah.
Right now, though, are going to sign out and see if this time the shiny new notebook actually allowed us to save the audio.
I'm praying to the Asus gods right now.
Oh, my goodness. There's nothing quite like a driver problem to make you realize how emotionally traumatic upgrading to a new PC can be.
I will say it was user error. I'm not going to put it on my notebook yet.
Okay. Error between keyboard and chair is a classic. You can find the writings and product suggestions for all of your home entertainment needs at heronfidelity.com. You can find me most of the time over at techthing.com, the show I do with Shannon Morris, a.k.a. Snubs. And you can find AVXL at avxl.com or search for it on iTunes, your favorite podcatcher. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, if our Kickstarter gets high enough, we will start doing video. And to learn more about that, go to patreon.com/AVEXCEL. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, again, our apologies for the delayed release of this episode. And if you are a patron, we'll be having our first online hangout shortly, and you should get an email for that. Seriously.
Awesome.
Thank you guys for sending in your questions to ask@avxl.com. Keep them coming and tweet at us too. And with that, I'm going to stop talking. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.